Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Student House is an organization that is conducting community-based research on the perceptions that young people in Canada have on housing and how that can be used to shape the housing future of Canada. While their research is Canada-wide, they are currently seeking input from students at Simon Fraser University on their personal experiences regarding housing. Co-founder of Student House, Julian Wells, who is a student himself, began the organization because, like many people his age, the prospect of owning a home began feeling like a false promise. CJSF sat down for an interview with Wells and spoke about the work Student House has achieved and where he hopes the research is able to lead the Canadian housing market in the future. Please take a listen.
Absolutely. So I founded Student House, which is an organization that helps people in the public sector, the nonprofit sector, and the private sector understand how young people, and particularly students, make housing decisions based on this like thesis that we should be building cities for people who are going to live in them in the future, not for kind of a backward-looking idea of people who are maybe already owning homes. We want to set future homeowners and renters and tenants up for success in the future.
And I guess what inspired you to found this, get involved in this capacity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a longer story. So I graduated from UVic in 2024 in May, but got involved in housing kind of in my second year after moving out. I'm initially from Toronto. I moved out to the West Coast to study, and very quickly realized just how much of a problem the housing crisis was. I lived on residence in my first year, and then in the second year was kind of thrown out to look for a place off campus. Took me months to find a place to live. I think I searched for hundreds of hours over the summer and had to settle for something that was way out of my price range and like 40 minutes away from campus, both of which were not ideal at all. So that kind of got me interested in getting involved further, and ended up starting a real estate club at UVic to kind of help young people understand their opportunity set in the space. And then got involved a little bit more politically and kind of understood the weight that young people's voices can carry in the political forum and in the housing forum, in terms of approvals processes and really in terms of decision making for how cities are built in the future. And that kind of kicked off research that I did across the country in terms of figuring out how young people make housing decisions. We surveyed a couple hundred students in Vancouver, Toronto, and Victoria, and were able to use our research to kind of help get thousands of housing units approved, honestly, which was super cool. And then once I graduated, I tried to figure out how to keep doing it, because I wanted to keep having the impact I was doing.
I wanted to ask you as well is if you could go into some of the organizations you're working alongside regarding, you know, these housing initiatives.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do kind of a broad range of things. I think one of the coolest organizations we're working with right now is Gen Squeeze, who are a nonprofit out of UBC, kind of founded and led by a UBC professor named Paul Kershaw. We're working with them on a cool advocacy campaign kind of around this idea of generational unfairness related to the housing wealth that sort of older Canadians who own homes might have, and that kind of increasing disparity with young people. We also work with people in the public sector and in the private sector, but those are relationships that like we kind of continue to build out. I've only been doing this kind of full time for the last 4 or 5 months, so we keep going for sure.
Yeah, and what kind of response have you gotten from, you know, people within the early to mid 20s age range, the people that are, you know, being most affected?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the kind of consistent feedback we've heard from young people has been this idea of a lack of affordability, which I'm sure is, it's not shocking to me, shouldn't be shocking to anyone, that young people are struggling and there's this really profound challenge that they're facing in the housing crisis. And we've been trying to solve that, but what we found is it's important to kind of tell these stories to the people who have the power to make changes. Mm-hmm. I think kind of some of the most important other takeaways there are, you know, in the same way that every kind of subset of the population has their own unique perspectives, and there's like different groups within that subset, students are exactly the same. No one student is like the same. No one student has the same perspectives. Some people want to live with friends in a basement apartment. Other people want to live at home. Other people want to live in small units, big units. There's a really broad idea of what matters to people across the country. But I think the two most important commonalities, or I guess the three, if we include that affordability piece I mentioned, was the shift away from cars. We're seeing a lot of students and young people kind of transitioning towards a desire of more walkable or more transit-oriented communities, which I also don't think is a huge surprise. And the second piece is that idea of like a 15-minute city. So like having amenities and having opportunities to kind of remain within a close area. So kind of, again, fitting into that like lack of car stereotype where you don't need to drive to get to everything that you need.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, these issues regarding affordability and housing, especially among younger people, this isn't anything that's new. It's been going on for quite a while. It's been getting a lot of coverage. Why do you think there hasn't been as much progress as there possibly could have been at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of layers to that. And I mean, first of all, I think like this is a deep-seated issue that Canada has been doing a poor job of addressing since like the 1990s. And really, things since then have continued to snowball, right? Like, if you don't build housing for anyone, if you don't build market rate housing for kind of the entire market, you're going to lack enough in the future. If you don't build enough today and your population consistently grows every year, yet you're still building at a shortfall, you're not meeting that demand that's coming in every year, you're just going to fall further and further behind. And that's what we've seen, is where we kept falling further and further behind. And in terms of why there hasn't been a lot of progress so far, I think there's a couple of pieces there, but I'll answer that with kind of the point that we're focused on with this Gen Squeeze partnership campaign that we're working on right now, where we've consistently heard that young people are struggling. And there's this idea of a political bargain that's happening with our political leaders, who have kind of made this compromise where they understand that over the last 20 years, as income and housing prices have kind of skyrocketed, or housing prices have skyrocketed and incomes have not, there's been this massive disparity in terms of wealth between people who are homeowners and people who aren't. And for young people, specifically those who are, you know, just getting started, they're renting, they're paying incredibly high rental prices, and homeowners are continuing to get a little bit wealthier from that housing wealth. And what we've seen from political leaders is this idea that disrupting that wealth, like concentrating on policies that would encourage home prices falling, would actually upset those homeowners who have their housing wealth tied up in this asset, or essentially they view it as an asset, a retirement asset. So what we have to kind of think about is the sacrifice that young people are making, right? That there's this bargain where young people are being asked to sacrifice their standard of living, pay higher rents in order to maintain the housing wealth of older homeowners. And we have to think about that, especially as we kind of get into some pretty pressing elections in the next couple months. How can we kind of flip that script? Is there a way where, you know, if it is for that to be upheld, can young people expect some kind of compensation there? I think there's tons of different ways that could happen, tons of different forms of compensation that we could see. But we have to really kind of start to accept this idea that young people are making a tremendous sacrifice, and there's not a ton of political appetite to disrupt the status quo, because people who are a really influential voting demographic are profiting off of it. You know, their housing wealth is growing and growing, and these are housing assets that are expected to be used in retirement. So disrupting that housing wealth is kind of an unpopular choice. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something we need to address.
That group of people you said is a popular voting demographic. Do you think part of that issue also stems from almost the expectation that younger age groups just aren't going to vote?
I think maybe. I think one of the things we've heard really consistently throughout our like anecdotal conversations with young people across the country is that when they do vote, housing is a critical issue, and their vote is pretty much defined. We've asked people the question, if you vote, would policy around youth housing funding or supporting and making housing more affordable for young people, would that change your vote? And the answer 99% of the time has been yes. So I think there's kind of a clear mandate from young voters to make it easier and more affordable for them to find housing. And I think that's something that our political leaders should look at. I think that youth engagement in politics is something that we need to focus on as a country. I think being engaged in politics, kind of going the extra mile beyond just voting is really important, but you know, make sure you go out and vote. It's always really important to have your voice heard. And I think there's this misrepresentation, this idea in our demographic that like your vote actually doesn't matter. And I'm here to tell you, like, your voice, your vote is incredibly powerful. We've seen that time and time again over the last year and a half of our work in the housing sector, that what young people think, what young people want, and what young people say matters. Simple as that. If you have the opportunity to share what you think with your local city councilors or with leaders, even in the housing sector, I've found that people in the housing sector are quite receptive to hearing what young people want. And I think it's just critical that we as a younger demographic share what we want, share our opinions, and make our feelings heard. If we don't like where we're at right now, we need to make it known so that our leaders can enact some change.
One thing I've been hearing you get at is almost just this expectation of, you know, going to university, getting a job after that, and eventually being able to own a home. And I think year by year, it continually feels less feasible.
100%.
I think, yeah, like one thing I'm hearing you get at is almost like this idea of compensation,
yep,
for that lost promise in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think where we're at right now is, you know, I think you described it perfectly. It's almost like an erosion of the Canadian dream, right? Like, I think people in this country, you go to university, you're told, we'll get a good job and you'll be able to set yourself up well for the future, get a good place to live and be able to live comfortably. And right now, that's just not the case at all. It's not the reality that we're dealing with. And I think we need to look at ways of flipping that script, that flipping that political bargain, and finding a way to incentivize political leaders, or show political leaders that young people care enough to kind of stand up and say, look, if we are going to be paying higher rents, if we are going to be kind of making this sacrifice to our standard of living by paying higher rents, we need some form of compensation. And I think there's tons of different ways that could take root. I think having that kind of in the form of funding for new housing for young people or for students, that's one option. A subsidy that would kind of act as like an intermediary between the landlord and the student. So the student pays less, but the landlord or home creator still gets the amount of money they need to create the home. Or some kind of funding that works to, I don't know. And there's so many different options you can look at there. And I think what's important here is we start the conversation and we show that there's appetite and interest from young people in something like this, and kind of start the discussion of saying, like, right now what's happening in our country is not okay. And I think, in my opinion, this is an issue that goes beyond like partisan politics. I think every party should care about this. In the upcoming elections, if you want youth votes, you should be focused on housing, and you should be focused on targeting housing to young people and figuring out how to get them out of the challenges that they're facing right now. And I think looking at creative solutions to make that happen has to be considered. Like, it's a big issue and something that I really feel like we don't hear about enough. I think, you know, I can get really in the weeds here, get really granular, but Canada's National Housing Strategy, which is kind of their guiding document for how they make housing decisions, how they fund different programs, it barely mentions students. It barely mentions young people. In fact, I think there's like $4 million out of their like $40 billion, maybe? I'm just ballparking here, so don't quote me on it, but like a very, very small percentage of Canada's housing expenditures go towards students. And now, of course, we also have to remember that housing is, at the end of the day, like a provincial responsibility, but there's more that the federal government could be doing. And there's more that every level of government should be doing. And I think that kind of comes back to the crux of the issue, which is every level of government, every sector, private sector, nonprofits, every level of government have to work together to come to a solution. Because there's no silver bullet solution for the housing crisis.
Once again, you were just listening to our interview with Julian Wells, co-founder of Student House, an organization that is advocating for increased affordability and accessibility of housing for youth in Canada. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Reporting from Port Moody, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. On January 14th, 2025, two members of the BCSPCA gave a presentation at a Port Moody City Council meeting that expressed the SPCA's issues and concerns with mobile petting zoos within the Lower Mainland. In their presentation, Kristen Jacob, a specialist in farm animal welfare, and Nadia Zanakis, a specialist in wild animal welfare, provided council with information that detailed the health and safety risks that these zoos not only pose for the animals in them, but for the public at large. Only a week after this delegation, a decision was made by Port Moody's Governance and Legislation Committee to ask that city staff create a corporate policy that would ban these zoos from operating in the city. CJSF was able to get in contact with Nadia Zanakis, the BC SPCA's specialist in wildlife animal welfare, who first presented to Port Moody City Council to discuss the SPCA's concerns with these mobile petting zoos. During our discussion with Zanakis, we first asked her to expand on the animal welfare concerns associated with these zoos.
Yeah, so we were invited by the Port Moody City Council to provide a presentation on the animal welfare concerns associated with these events. So they're just looking for kind of testimony from experts in this area to provide more information. And so the risks with events like these are to animal welfare for the animals themselves, so risks to their psychological and their physical health. So these events are very stressful. They usually feature exotic animals, which are just wild animals from another country. So we don't usually think of animals like raccoons as pets or companion animals. But when we see kind of reptiles or parrots or animals of that nature, essentially that's what they are, just wild animals from another country we've brought into Canada that are used for these events or used as companion animals. And so that's not really part of their natural habitat. It's very hard to meet their five freedoms in captivity. So there's a lot of concerns for their welfare at events like these, where they may not be given time to rest. They may constantly be being handled either appropriately or inappropriately. They can be stepped on. There's a lot of risk to their physical safety as well as a health and safety component for people. So there's a lot of mixing of animals and humans. That's a risk for Salmonella, E. coli, and we've seen avian influenza heavily featured in the news right now as well. So those are all kind of risks, including physical risks as well. So some events can feature larger mammals. Animals can be unpredictable when they're stressed. They can shed pathogens more heavily when they're stressed. So it's just kind of a mix of a lot of risk involved with these events.
Afterwards, Zanakis expanded on some of the public education work that the BC SPCA is advocating for, as well as the need for better standards in regards to wild animal welfare.
Yeah, we are constantly aiming to kind of provide education, seasonal education, as things pop up in the media. Servals, for example, usually have kind of an annual appearance in the media when one escapes and perhaps they are loose in an area and they might be attacking kind of outdoor cats. We really try to use opportunities like that to spread awareness about these issues. And really what we're advocating for is the Controlled Alien Species Act is provincial legislation. It's a negative list currently. So it means that it only lists the animals you cannot have. But the problem with that is there's new animals popping up all the time with trends and kind of new pets or animals that people are interested in having. And we can't keep up with kind of updating it to reflect the changes that are happening at the time. So servals, for example, aren't on the controlled alien species list. So people can legally have these animals, and as we've seen, there's issues with that. So what we're advocating for is a positive list. So instead, we would list only the species you're allowed to have, and it covers everything else. So you don't have to worry about kind of new trends popping up and having to update the legislation. And we think it'd be, it would fill a lot of gaps that way. So that's one thing that we're advocating for. And we're hoping that we can continue to work on this.
Lastly, we asked Zanakis to give her thoughts on the City of Port Moody's recent decision to look into the banning of these mobile petting zoos. Here's what she had to say.
Yeah, we think it's fantastic. So Port Moody is really like a championing leader in this space. They're the first to kind of pass kind of legislation like this. And I think it's an important first step to start having these conversations, and maybe others might want to follow suit. But there's a lot of work that kind of needs to go into this issue. So from a municipal level, this is a great, fantastic step, and we're so thrilled to see it. But there's multiple levels of government that could be involved in this. So we are also advocating provincially to the provincial government as well for stronger restrictions on these types of animals.
Once again, that was Nadia Zanakis, the BC SPCA's specialist in wildlife animal welfare, who gave her thoughts on the City of Port Moody's decision to look into creating a corporate policy that would ban mobile petting zoos from operating in the city. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, find us on social media, and please support our vital work through our website.
My name is Vanessa, or Lefan, my Chinese name. My artist name is Van Lefan, and I was one of the co-writers. So I grew up in Taiwan, so I'm fluent in Mandarin and Taiwanese, or Hokkien. So when we were in the process of writing that song, I was kind of in charge of writing most of the Chinese language bits. So I was probably the most fluent out of three of us. Wakapa's pretty fluent too, but he just wrote the rap bits, so yeah, for the rest of the song. That was my role. I'm a JMF artist. I think I've played like 3 years now.
Yeah, my name is Daniel Liu. I'm a musician, originally from Coquitlam, third generation Chinese. So I've been quite removed from Chinese languages and a lot of the culture itself. And so I was brought into Jade Music Festival. I guess their organization is called the Society of We Are Canadians Too. I got connected with them a couple years ago, and it was an amazing opportunity to start merging my love of music with kind of like reclaiming my own heritage and breaking down my own walls of being able to connect with the language primarily in a musical context. So as I've been doing that, I've been getting to know the other artists like Vanessa, and so that's led us to this moment where we were put in a position where we could co-write something for the Lunar New Year, kind of merging kind of a multilingual project.
What can you tell me about how this project started?
It was Charlie from J Music Festival between their team. I'm not sure if Charlie was the main spearheader, but just like the JMF team decided to come up with this red envelope idea. So instead of having money in their red envelopes, they wanted to have a QR code to a song, an original song by the JMF artist that's about the Lunar New Year that can be presented at Lunar Fest and to different partners and things like that. So at the last JMF in November, they announced it to us as the group of artists and asked who would like to take that on. And I think after a couple of weeks, Gina Lena ended up agreeing to lead the project for them and kind of produce the project and bring the group together. So then she came to our like artist group chat and kind of asked who would be interested and available for this day to write, this day for studio time. And because it was a very, very short turnaround time. So it turns out that basically me, Dan, and Gina were the only ones that were willing and able to fulfill those deadlines. And then Kappa kind of hopped on later. There were other people who were interested, but just because the timeline was so tight, we weren't able to include everybody. But yeah, that's kind of how the fellowship was assembled.
Had you thought about writing a song about Lunar New Year before, or was this a like completely new departure?
I've never thought of writing a holiday song. I think I've like sarcastically thought about writing Christmas music, but I've never gone through with it out of the fear of it just being cheesy.
Yeah, I didn't think about writing a song like this either. It was just very spur of the moment. We were kind of just pitched the idea, and then seemed like something to challenge myself to do.
Daniel, you had mentioned sort of reconnecting with your Chinese heritage through language and music. And well, Vanessa, you were just saying you had sort of thought about writing holiday music, but thought it might be cheesy or whatever. In hindsight, having now written a holiday song, what did that feel like? And what does it feel like in hindsight?
I think once I like kind of let go, I think having a short timeline and a very specific topic kind of like opened things up by like closing off other considerations or worries, where it's like, okay, well, I'm not precious about it being like the most amazing single I'm ever going to drop. It is what it is. It's a holiday song. It's supposed to be like poppy and like feel good. You don't have to like think too hard about it. But yeah, just like be too precious, because I think when there's no time, you kind of just have to make decisions. You can't tinker with details forever. So in hindsight, I don't know, it was fun. And I think it was like a good flex of the songwriting muscles to just try something out of genre for me and out on a topic that I wouldn't normally speak about and still find something. that feels fulfilling. And I think the collaborative process and knowing that we could write and record a song in 2 weeks was kind of what I took out of it. And it's also just fun to collaborate and try new things with new people.
Yeah, and I think, kind of stepping outside of